Welcome to this week's edition of the Quill Report and Weekly Review. This is coming a little later than normal as because of the holidays and travel and so forth. So Paul Harrell and I, Dominic Aquila, are coming to you the day after instead of the day before that you normally, after you receive the newsletter. So you, if you've received your newsletter and read it, you've already gotten your top 10. So we thought it would be interesting this time for us to be able to give our assessment after the fact instead of waiting, not doing anything. And so it's going to be interesting to observe what you think as you have the articles already in front of you. So Paul, it's firecracker weekend or week.
Oh, yeah.
And a celebration. I hope that your celebration, your family was good.
Yeah, it is. My daughter's birthday is today, and so we always kind of lump in the 4th and her birthday with the family and everything. So we had a
great
time, and obviously, you know, recognized what many call Presbyterian Revolt Day.
That's
we
right.
had a good time.
Well, somebody sent me an email. Let me see if I can find it real quick here. It was a reminder of something that was posted last year by a Presbyterian minister. He said, as you celebrate the 4th of July, just remember that King George III called it the Presbyterian Rebellion. Also, the Honorable Horace Walpole, upon hearing of the insurrection in the American colonies, rose from his seat in the English House of Commons to declare that, quote, cousin American has run off with a Presbyterian parson. So that's how they viewed it. So there's we have that attestation from a member of parliament back in 1776 that they have run off with a Presbyterian parson. That's a funny way to put it. So.
Definitely.
Anyway, so with that in mind, we can come to this as well. By the way, since it's your daughter's birthday, it's my daughter-in-law's one of my daughters-in-law's birthday, and also my wife and I celebrating our 55th anniversary as well. So it's a happy
congratulations.
Day.
That's awesome.
It is. It's really wonderful. Okay, so let's begin. Paul, you read the top 10 from 10 to 6. I'll read from 5 to 1, and then we'll get our discussion rolling.
All right, number 10, we have Brianna Herlihy, I think I pronounced that correctly, I hope. Forgive me if I'm not. And Ron Blitzer, Supreme Court rules in favor of Colorado graphic designer who refused to create same-sex wedding website. Number 9. From last week, Aaron M. Wren, there are plenty of good fish in the sea. Number 8, we have Kevin DeYoung, two sexes created to be distinct. Number 7, three things a Christian should consider before serving in the military. This is by J.V. Fesco. And number 6, Ryan Beasy, encouragements from the Jubilee Assembly.
Okay, then number 5 is Carl Truman, toe the government line or lose your kids. Number 4 is the unfortunate title, Queering Jesus, How It's Going Mainstream at Progressive Churches and Top Divinity Schools by John Murawski. Number 3 is Ruling Elder Renaissance by Brad Isbell. Then we have number 2 is a summer report of the Reformed Presbyterian Church Synod. That's the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America, sometimes called the Covenanters. And then number 1, summer report of the Christian Reformed Church Synod 2023. And since that's number 1, we'll pick up with that one and just give brief interviews overview since you have the articles in front of you. If you're listening to this with your device open, you can follow along and see what it's all about. But it's a good summary that is presented by the Synod itself with regard to some of the top actions that were taken at the Christian Reformed Church Synod that was held in June of this year. And Synod 2023, it said, first of all, rejects Neyland Avenue CRC's appeal. From last year's Synod, as we were told here, there was a letter, a note that was given after the Christian Reformed Church Synod had passed a amendment to their Heidelberg Catechism, which is one of their statements of confession of faith, that a woman has in a same-sex marriage and yet elected as a deacon, that wouldn't stand under the scrutiny now of the new directive that with that appointment, with the approval of the insertion of the new language into the Heidelberg Catechism. And so Neyland Avenue was told that they had to stop that, and they came back this year and appealed it, and they lost it. The appeal was defeated by a vote of 124-47, with 6 delegates abstaining. Synod's 2023's decision followed a review of the situation by an in loco, that is, in place committee that had been mandated to act on behalf of last year's Synod in 2022, as well as deliberation by this year's Synod 2023 advisory committee, and passionate debate from delegates for and against the Neyland Avenue's action. And so the basic bottom line is that the Synod denied the appeal and informed the church that they had to remove the deacon from her position, and that she no longer meets the biblical qualifications for being a deacon. Along with that, there was an urging, though, of the Synod to show love and inclusion, and to be more open to LGBTQ plus members. So it said, Synod urged congregations to be places of belonging for LGBTQ plus members seeking to follow Christ, and instruct churches to show love to all people groups, including our LGBTQ members and neighbors, by condemning hateful or demeaning speech and violent or demeaning actions. Further, Synod 2023's discussion of confessional difficulties cut short the delegates' protest. And what was is that what began as a conversation to discuss the gravamen, that's a language for an expression of difficulty or some problem that someone might have with a confessional statement, in the final hour of the Synod 23 ended in delegates walking out in protest. On Thursday afternoon, with just an hour and a half left of Synod 2023, a majority report and minority report were presented to Synod to discuss the concept of a confessional difficulty gravamen. According to the majority report, a confessional difficulty gravamen is intended to allow office bearers to honestly question doctrinal matters contained in our confessions, giving them space to wrestle with the biblical accuracy of these doctrines, while also ensuring that there would be a season of pastoral care provided for the office bearer and his or her struggle for clarification. And the committee presented their report, and he says, we need to have guardrails in place, and those guardrails are also already in place by the confession. So the Synod decided that the wiggle room, or the amount of space given for for holding to any position that's contrary to the confessional statement is very limited. The also talked about the 2023 asks the regional group to guide into compliance erring office bearers. So any group, any person who is an ordained officer would be held to account, and said that they must follow the principles laid out in the articles and in the confessional statements of the Christian Reformed Church. Then Synod upholds confessional status as interpretation of unchastity. And so that would also came that the unchastity in the Heidelberg Catechism includes homosexual sex, and upheld the confessional status of that interpretation. So one of those things that the CRC Synod had dealt with. And Synod says no to delaying actions on the human sexuality report, and that had been received last year by the Synod. Synod 2020 turned down requests from several Christian Reformed churches and classes to delay implementation of the inclusions of the human sexuality report, which last year Synod approved for church use. And there were folks who said it was too early. Let's let it go for study, but not yet approval and adoption. It says the statement approved by Synod 2023, however, argues that the urgency of pastoral care for LGBTQ plus people is a reason not to delay implementing the recommendations in the report. And then there's also, they covered something on assisted suicide, and they gave some counsel to the church with regard to that. And many of a number of other things here. So it was a very active synod for the Christian Reformed Church. And you can, there's more on the report here, and your link, there are links in it to take you to other reports that and other action items that the Christian Reformed Church took up. So it was a busy report, just as what we had reported on the Presbyterian Church in America's report. There's going to be one coming up on the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America. So the time of the year when churches are dealing with these major issues, they confront us in the pew and in the pulpit. So Paul, that's a mouthful there, isn't it?
It is. It's interesting to see like a snapshot of what other denominations are going through. And again, there's definitely some crossover, but then you have interesting things they're wrestling with, like whether or not a minister should marry a couple who doesn't want to use the civil government, doesn't want to get an actual marriage license, and they passed a synod essentially saying don't do it if they're not going to get a civil marriage license as well, which this is just an interesting issue to me. However, at the same time, they want to respect and honor the marriages of indigenous peoples and immigrants who do not have civil marriage licenses. And then they have this, so this denomination has seats women delegates, and there is a provision to where you can protest that at their General Assembly or the
Synod.
The Synod, sorry. And so they're now saying that they're no longer going to allow people to vocally protest the seating of female delegates based on Scripture. But they used to. That was in their Book of Church Order. But now they're not going to be able to do that. So anyway, interesting hills, if you will. So,
yeah, well, and then number two with the Reformed Presbyterian Church in North America, like I said, sometimes it's referred to as the Covenanters because of their history coming out of the Covenanters of Scotland. This was their 191st synod that was held, met at Wesleyan University in Marion, Indiana. And this report written by Nathan Eshelman, basically they had, compared to what we just read with the Christian Reformed Church, a much quieter general assembly. And nominations were open, he said, for moderator, much to his surprise, Dr. Peter Smith of Covenant Fellowship, Reformed Presbyterian Church, was elected. And he says that he was an excellent moderator. They had some internal business to take up with a number of complaints. A complaint is a written representation about some alleged error that was taken up by a court, whether a session, an elder board, or a presbytery. And so they had a number of those that came before this assembly, and you can read about those. There was a study committee as well on judicial commissions. Over the last year, two commissions had been working with the former leadership of a congregation that was sadly caught in the middle of a minor-on-minor sexual abuse scandal. And that particular event, they don't mention it specifically here, did create quite a bit of distress in the life of the RPCNA. And so it led to the pastor being deposed and suspended from communion, and the elders were suspended from their office. So it gives a follow-up on that issue. But most of the other reports here from as Nathan Eshelman gives it to us here, it was very uplifting and shows the RPCNA is wrestling with a number of good issues and following, you know, very in typical Presbyterian fashion, clearly and methodically looking at each issue before they make any decision. Paul, what you think about that one? That's a little bit different than the Christian Reformed Synod.
Yeah, you know, I think I would love to get your take on it, honestly, Dominic. I mean, I know we have two different denominations here, but does there appear to be in these, you know, Reformed Presbyterian denominations, there does appear to be that the pendulum is maybe swinging back the other way, back towards confessionalism, mm-hmm. back towards the, I mean, it's slower and it's different. People are different stages.
Yes.
But that does appear to be happening across the board.
I think that's a good general assessment. And in fact, as you know, I've said a number of times here on our podcast, that in my teaching church history, one of the things that I point out to the students is that every generation of the church, going right back to the first century and right up to the 21st, has had always had to face issues, both those that were internal and then those that where the church had to wrestle with things that were external that might come into the church. And so it's a regular and it's a constant. And the thing to put into frame is that things don't change overnight. Issues come up, they're dealt with, but it takes time to resolve them as people filter. So it shows how the church is in the culture. It's not going to become a necessary part of it. So if you give it time, you take the steps, then things will, you know, be they would go well with regard to that. So so we mentioned, in fact, the next article, let me just go ahead and jump to that, Paul, while we're answering this question, is by Brett Isbell, Ruling Elder Renaissance. And he's talking about it in the context of the Presbyterian Church in America and the issues that we've been dealing with in the Presbyterian Church in America, the PCA, over the last 5-6 years, as it took a while for all the parts to come together in a way that could help, not necessarily resolve, but at least bring clarity and definition to what the issues were so that we could live with them within the denomination as a whole and in churches in particular. So it's important to realize that just because the main courts of the church or the top courts always meet just once a year, so it takes a while. But even in the local church, where things are being wrestled with inside the church with how are we going to respond to this social issue or culture event, even there, you need study, you need time to make sure what is happening is, you're taking care of it carefully and not just rushing into making a decision and how to resolve it, so forth. So just while I'm talking right now, let me just move to Article 3 with it. Brad Isbell wrote, he says, the recently concluded 50th Presbyterian Church in America Assembly in Memphis was the second largest ever, officially anyway. There were 2,250 elders, that's both ruling and teaching elders, in attendance. Only the previous year, which was in 2022, assembly was larger with 2,385. So that's 2,385 in attendance. More significantly, this year's meeting solidified a trend of a greater ruling elder participation in the PCA. And that is something that what Brad is, he himself is a ruling elder, and a number of others started a group called MORE in the PCA, and MORE stands for More Orthodox Ruling Elders, that they were trying to encourage churches to send their ruling elders to General Assembly, as well as be involved at the presbytery level as well. So he goes on to say that the parity of the two classes of elder, ruling and teaching, ruling is the lay elder, teaching the ordained minister, and the PCA is a noble feature of PCA polity. Most committees are structured so that equal numbers of ruling and teaching elders are possible if fully attended. The principle of parity is baked into the whole dynamic of the PCA, and the reality of parity has been harder, though, to achieve, especially at the higher court level. And various reasons for this difficulty have risen, but most agree that the high cost of attendance and or need for a week off from work for the ruling elders, or at least partially to blame. So it's interesting, he notes that the first PCA General Assembly in 1973, saw more ruling elders than teaching elders at its tracks. But it, then a downward trend began, so that during sort of the middle parts of the coming into 2000, the number was much less, averaging about 23% up to that point. And this year it was 30% plus. So he's just celebrating the fact that more ruling elders are involved, and he gives some background to this. So if you're interested in that, and if you're a ruling elder or pastor who's encouraging your elders to be more involved in the higher courts, the Presbyterian General Assembly, this is an article that will encourage you very much. So does that did I answer your question, or did I ramble?
No, absolutely you did. And I think this is a great article, and it does chart the trajectory in the recent years of ruling elders becoming more involved, and they became more involved. What was interesting to me is I didn't realize that they fell off so much after the initial ruling elder participation in the General Assembly fell off pretty sharply, not soon after the founding of the PCA. And I didn't realize that part, and that's here in the article. But these controversies, and I think it was Revoice and Side B that was the biggest one, and obviously just ruling elders in the denomination looking across the culture and seeing what's going on, and you know, living in it every single day as lay people, and going about their jobs. And I think that's kind of what stirred them up. And then organizations, of course, like More and the PCA are doing great work, you know, getting more ruling elders to participate and really having a representative form of government where, you know, we have these churches being represented more accurately, I think, is what's happened. Mm-hmm. I think your local churches are being represented more accurately now than they were, you know, when there were less ruling elders showing up.
Exactly. They have been. In fact, if not, we could wind up where the next article number four, takes us. And this one, it really is. It's sort of a difficult one to even, you know, the title of it even can be. It is offensive. The title, Queering Jesus, How It's Going Mainstream at Progressive Churches and Top Divinity Schools. And the reason for this is that we can see that somewhere along the line, these churches that are, quote, the mainstream churches or progressive or the top divinity schools, they started, you know, with probably a little seed of thought on this, and it is now morphed into what we have. And so there's a, you know, just a wide, broad gap between those churches like the PCA that wrestled with this matter through Revoice over the last 5-6 years, and how it rendered its decision versus how other denominations over the last 60-70 years have arrived at the where they are theologically. So this sort of article is sort of encapsulating, showing this is where you wind up if you don't stop at the progress of a particular thought that from almost every metric would be antithetical to biblical and historic Christianity. So, for instance, uses a couple of vignettes are put here in this article. A Presbyterian church goes viral online for marketing the Transgender Day of Visibility with a public prayer to the God of Pronouns. The congregants of the First Presbyterian Church of Iowa City pay obeisance to, quote, the God of Trans Being, giving due glory to the great they, them. Or the United Methodist Church boasts that the first drag queen in the world to become a certified candidate for ordination. This traveling minister, who describes drag ministry as a divine duty, is lauded by a Florida pastor as an angel in heels. After appearing in that church in a sequence dress, deliver a children's sermon and denounce the privilege of whiteness and cisness. That's as CIS, if you know that internal language. Or at Duke University's Methodist affiliated divinity school, pastors in training and future religious leaders conduct a pride worship service in which they glorify the great queer one, fluid and ever becoming one. The service leads off with a prayer honoring God as queerness incarnate. You are drag queen and trans man and gender fluid, incapable of limiting your vast expression of beauty. So just hearing all of that, you know, can be overwhelming to the ears and notions and ideas of churches within the broader evangelical movement within the U.S. or around the world. So the author goes on to say here, these examples from this year and last are just a few of the illustrating how progressive churches are moving beyond gay rights, even beyond transgender acceptance, and venturing into the realm of queer theology, rather than merely settling for the acceptance of gender nonconforming people within existing marital norms and social expectations. Queer theology questions heterosexual assumptions and binary gender norms as limiting, oppressive, and anti-biblical, and centers queerness as the redemptive message of Christianity. Just one more. In this form of worship, queering encourages the faithful to problemize, disrupt, and destabilize the assumptions behind heteronormativity, get that right, and related social structures such as monogamy, marriage, and capitalism. These provocative theologians and ministers assert that queerness is not only natural and healthy, but biblically celebrated. They assert that God is not the patron deity of the respectful, the respectable, the privileged, and the comfortable, but rather God has a preferential option for the promiscuous, the outcast, and the excluded, and the impure. So that sets the matter up in terms of the debate in the church and where things could have gone in churches, because, okay, here comes Paul. The slippery slope is real. Yes. And this article really shows that where it devolves into, because this thing never stops evolving. It just keeps going and going because the boundary lines, the restraints, the guardrails have been taken away. And then anything goes for the church if they start down this road. So that's where we are right now. And this article basically is just laying out, this is where it has gone. It's unrestrained. It's moving forward. And it's going to keep on going living in the cesspool or its demise.
You know, this is so dangerous. I mean, we're taking the sexual depravity of man, and we are now, these people are trying to apply our sinful characteristics to God. Now, and look, I know all of us at one time or another have figured out ways to justify our sin, but this is next level. This really is. I mean, we've seen it in the Bible. I mean, to me, this is one step away from the Sodom and Gomorrah, the Sodomites demanding the angels, at Lot's door saying, I mean, it's very similar to this, where we are trying to essentially take our sinful characteristics and apply it to heavenly natures, and man, it is really just, it's disgusting. Now, the second point would be, because these are, quote, churches, end quote, and I use those, quote, but they, claim to be of Christ, right? And they're perverting it. But if you go look up the millstone verses, I think in Matthew and Mark, and you read those two verses that says, it would be better for a millstone to be tied around your neck and thrown into the sea than to cause one of these little ones to stumble. These are causing children to stumble for sure. And that verse, as much as I would love to apply that verse to the pagans in the culture, like the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence and all of the mockery that they do of Christ and Christians at the Los Angeles Dodgers baseball game and everything else, that verse is actually not applicable to pagans. It's applicable, most applicable to the Christians, to people who claim to be Christians. That Jesus was talking to the disciples when he said that it would be better for a millstone to be tied around your neck and thrown into sea than to cause these little ones to stumble. And that's what we're seeing here. We are literally, I mean, Millstone Factory. I mean, we just did open one up because that's where this is all headed. So
it is. And well, it may lead not only to the continual downward slope of theology and life. Then there's the application, and then the fifth article with by Carl Truman, "Toe the Government Line or Lose Your Kids," comes out of this. He starts out in a strange but eloquent example of irony, the news that the UK, that is United Kingdom's National Health Service, is banning hormone treatment and transgender surgeries for minors, arrived just as I was reading the text of a proposed California bill that would make refusal to affirm a child's transgender confusion an offense for which a parent could lose custody. The bill, called the Transgender Diversive and Intersex Youth Empowerment Act, would require courts to consider a parent's acceptance of his or her child's gender identity when deciding custody in visitation cases. So what he's saying is that if you don't accept it, the court may not allow you to have custody of your child, or maybe even visitation rights. So he says, just in one of the concluding sort of a synopses here, "Much of this derives from the dominance of therapeutic or psychological categories in a world where many adults increasingly see every criticism as a personal attack and every disagreement as some form of malicious gaslighting. It is not surprising that children's mental health has been expanded to include affirmation, even of the most egregious confusion culture of identity has generated. What is deeply troubling is that the subjectivism is now becoming an instrument for attenuating the relationship between parents and children. In the past, a bruise or a broken bone might trigger an entirely appropriate intervention by social services, but our present age is in a new and rather nasty one. Here, the bizarre excesses of the most implausible academic theories combined with the commercial concerns of the pharmaceutical industry and the moral bankruptcy of a political caste interested only in pandering to the most unhinged sexual revolutionaries. In such a world, parenting," and that's in quotes, "to use the egregious verbal form, becomes a matter of political taste to be policed by the state. Children become the means by which lunacy is enforced by virtual fiat. Toe the line or lose your kids." And so in this, this thinking, of course, in our country, of course, we think that California is sort of the, we usually talk about the left coast. It's becoming even worse than that, unfortunately. But here's a note of optimism, because I think that it reaches a point, and Paul, you used the phrase there a minute that we're moving towards, or as a title of a book by Barbara Bork was Slouching Towards Gomorrah. Despite this latest lunacy, we read here, "I remain confident that the trans madness will come to an end." That's an interesting statement by Truman. "Though sadly, not without significant human carnage. Those responsible for this child abuse, the doctors, the clinics, and the pharmaceutical companies, are going to be sued and will pay a heavy price. This is America, folks. The established ideology is ultimately only plausible as long as it's making, not costing money. And once those groups start paying out to settle such suits, as if by magic, their beliefs will change overnight." So you always follow the money is what comes out here. So we might also hope that the long arm of the law also eventually feels the collar of those lawmakers who have enabled this scandal to take place by the passing a law that might come out like as being referred to here in this article. So there's always a shift. You just go down the hill, you go down that slope, and then at some point, you just can't take it anymore, and there's a reversal. But by that time, you look back and you see you're floating through a wake of bodies that have been cast overboard and are now just floating in the water. You know, it's a real shame that has to happen, but that's what happens when we break out of the restraints that God has put here for the common benefits even of unbelievers, even though they don't like those restraints. They want to express themselves without anybody telling them anything, including God. So I think this is a very telling overview editorial comment that Carl Truman gives us.
No doubt. And, you know, he says when he talks about the law, you know, we might also hope the long arm of the law also eventually feels the collar of those lawmakers who have enabled this scandal. Sadly, of course, this will only come about after the willful destruction of the lives of many children who were simply in the wrong place, a morally bankrupt society at the wrong time. And he's exactly right. And I've said this on the program before, but that's you're going to see the big push in these local legislatures in the near future is going to be classifying this as child abuse. I kind of see this California law saying, look, if you don't use your kids' pronouns, you're going to lose custody. If we're in a custody battle between the mother and the father, the judge is going to have to give the kids to whoever's using the proper pronouns. The incorrect pronouns is the real truth of the matter. It's fundamentally an anti-Christian law. There was a state senator who's, from California, northern, more of a conservative area, very little of those left, who said from the committee hearing, he said, look, normally I would say we should rally, we should fight this, we should, organize. He was like, but I can't tell you to do that anymore. And he basically waved the white flag. He said, we've lost. And he said, if you care about your children, you will leave the state of California. You will flee the state of California because it's lost. And that's true. But I do see this law in California is kind of the total polar opposite counterpart of laws and drafts that are out there that want to put this type of behavior under the child abuse statutes. And what that would fundamentally mean practically is that if you're in a state that bars the mutilation of genitals or chemical castration with hormones and that sort of thing, if you live in that state and you're a parent that believes in it anyway and wants to have it done to your child and goes to California to have it done where it's legal, when you come back home, you are still guilty of child abuse. Now, that has profound implications. But that's the battle lines, and that's where it's really going to be duked out, if you will, in the coming years.
Right, it is. Okay, well, now we return to another assessment of the Presbyterian Church in America General Assembly. This is by Pastor Ryan Beasy. Encouragements from the Jubilee Assembly, since it was the 50th year of the PCA celebrating its founding in 1973 and celebrating 50 years later. It says one former PCA moderator characterized the Memphis Assembly as, quote, the most significant in a generation, close quote. The PCA has been at a crossroads, as noted, among other places. And then he gives some citations of where you can see that. And it goes back that over these last 5-6 years, It has been at crossroads. Paul, you and I have talked about it on this podcast, and the Cool Report has had articles taking note of it as well. They have been at the crossroads. She decides whether to be a confessional Reformed church committed to walking in the old paths of piety and discipleship, or a broadly evangelical, culturally missional, reactionary communion. So he says, in the Memphis Assembly chose to walk the old paths of the Reformed faith, as evidenced by both acts of the assembly and the men elected to her permanent committees and agencies, and including the Standing Judicial Commission. In addition to the greater manifestation of unity, a return to growth numerically and in terms of giving, increased elder participation, and unity of chastity for officers, there were other less obvious encouragements not to be overlooked regarding the health of the PCA. So he then goes on and gives some of those. For instance, he talked about the rising ministerial standards. It goes back to a number of things that we just mentioned, Paul, of the changes, amendments to the Book of Church Order that just clarifies the meaning of above reproach and the importance of the caliber, the quality of manner in which the officers in the church are to be conducting themselves. The commitment to historic PCA polity, how do we internally rule ourselves. So there's, you know, two ways that the church is to be seen in the broadest categories. It's an organic body. That is, it's alive, it's breathing, it's growing, it's multiplying, it's even going through cell division as it grows within itself, so that there is integrity in that life organically. And then it's an organization. And so the organization is the skeletal structure and the thing that holds the rest of the body up, if you would. And so you need to make sure that you do good temple maintenance, if you would, on that. So the polity or the church government becomes important. How do we govern ourselves in such a way that it promotes the best for the church? It's peace, it's purity, and it's unity. The overview, strong review and control, that there's in the Presbyterian system a good review of, there's the session, and then there's the presbytery, and the presbytery can oversee the sessions, and they do that by meeting together and holding each other accountable, and then also reviewing the session minutes. And in the General Assembly, they're doing the same thing for presbyteries, so that we're able to hold ourselves accountable to one another in that kind of way. The also rejection, he says, of reactionary appeals and logical fallacies. He gives examples, and some hits have come to the PCA after its General Assembly was over because of a number of overtures that were presented that were not accepted, and people criticized because the church, they felt, said, was not willing to look at these things. And the argument back in Pastor Beasley deals with this is to say, no, it's just they were poorly drafted. They were more reactionary than they were thoughtful. And if you want to think it through a little bit more and bring back something that has a broader appeal or has clarity to it, then we'll consider it. And so we weren't just going to fall into the sympathy mode. And so he just mentions a number of other things, that these are encouraging trends that we see in the PCA. And I'm so glad that he sort of gave that broad overview so that we have a different way of looking in the midst of what we just talked about, the queering theology, as well as what's taking place in California and so forth, that the restraints are in place, the guardrails are there, the confessions in good order, the scriptures authority is being maintained. So, Paul, that's a healthy perspective to have here.
Yeah, absolutely. It also mentions, the strong review and control mechanisms were essentially enforced. Talked about how the issue of Metro New York Presbytery seems especially significant. In this instance, the RPR committee reviewed the minutes of the presbytery. They considered the minutes themselves to reflect a credible report of an important delinquency or grossly unconstitutional proceeding, BCO 40-5. In other words, the minutes of presbytery recorded the presbytery acting in a delinquent or otherwise grossly unconstitutional manner, to such an extent that the RPR committee believed the General Assembly's Judicial Commission needed to examine the matter more thoroughly. While what is reported in the Metro New York is no doubt regrettable and troubling, the recommendation of the RPR committee and the action of the Assembly indicate both the Assembly and her committee are committed to a healthy review of records and to faithfully enforce the Constitution of the Church. Of course, this was a controversy having to do with a priestess, if you will, a Episcopal Church priestess delivering a sermon on a Sunday morning at a church within the New York Metro Presbytery. So that was his Ryan Beasley's recollection of reporting on that was really good. And then also number four is good. You guys should read that one. Rejection of reactionary appeals and logical fallacies. That's also a really good summary of what went on.
Good. It is helpful. Okay. Then move to the next one is by John Fesco. And he takes us in a different direction. Three things a Christian should consider before serving in the military. Presbyterians, as we already noted early on, as we started celebrating the fourth, we talked about the, King George III thought the Revolutionary War was the Presbyterians' war. So Presbyterians, evangelicals, have been very committed to being a part of the culture, including service in the military. So he just says, among many legitimate vocations that Christians can pursue, military service is certainly an acceptable choice. Serving in the military can be very beneficial. Many young people have testified to the fact that military service helped them grow up to be responsible adults. Many have taken advantage of financial assistance programs to help pay for college, and others have learned much about leadership, service, and honor by serving in the military. There are also many benefits of learning technical trades or even learning a unique skill, such as how to fly an aircraft, and that leads to long and profitable careers in later in the civilian life. So in that regard, he says, I just want to provide counsel to young person if he or she was considering military service. And it's just a good pastoral awareness. For instance, he said, I would ensure that the person was very spiritually mature, that the Christian has a strong will, that is a dogged commitment to serve Christ and continually strive for greater sanctification. And then also third, that the Christian has a strong commitment to the Bible's teaching on the image of God, and he explains each of those very carefully. So I think it's just a helpful pastoral advice. This is an area where a individual feels prompted to think about and get involved in. To at least these three pastoral statements are very something to consider for the young person.
Yeah, I've often wondered this over the last year or so, you know, is there a place for a Christian in the United States military anymore? And I'm going to say the answer is definitely not no, not, you know, absolutely not, because, you know, that's the beauty of Christ, and that's Christians. We kind of have people everywhere, you know. We're actually a much better intelligence agency. You know, we have, the Lord puts people everywhere, you know. But I have wondered, you know, specifically with how anti-Christian they seem to be. I don't necessarily know if the official policy of the U.S. government, I don't know if they want Christians in the military right now, you know. But this is a helpful article. It certainly gets you thinking about it. I think the third point here really kind of struck me, that the prayer needs to be you as a Christian soldier in the military are the sharp point of the magistrate's sword, but you don't basically become a soulless killer and not numb to all the death and destruction you see around you, and how that if you are going to go in, that needs to, and you're going to see combat, that's got to be your prayer, that you don't basically no longer see your enemy as a human created by God, but somehow you see them as subhuman, and how that just takes a toll on somebody's soul. And so that kind of hit me right between the eyes. That is certainly a big risk. So,
yeah, it is. Okay, then next article, number 8, is by Kevin DeYoung, Two Sexes Created to Be Distinct. It's a title that's very much a part of what we've just been talking about, how the culture is trying to say that instead of being a binary, that is two sexes, that we're non-binary, and that means you have a gender fluidity. You could be either or one or the other, or any combination that you can make up, and that's not the appropriate thing. And in this article, though, Kevin is taking it in a little bit different area with regard not only to the binary, non-binary principle, he's talking about even to the point of why the scripture gives a mandate, like in Deuteronomy 22, a woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's cloak, for whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. He says, I know that citing a verse from the law of Moses can be fraught with difficulties. Why should we listen to a verse that was just a few verses later? God tells his people not to sow with two kinds of seed and not to wear the cloth of wool and linen mixed together. For starters, he said Jesus did not come to abolish the law or the prophets, but to fulfill them. So before we throw out any Old Testament command, we should at least be prepared to explain how Jesus has fulfilled the command and transpose it to another key. Likewise, if the sacred writings are able to make us wise to salvation, and if all scripture is breathed out by God and profitable, then every part of the Old Testament has something to teach us about God's will. This is especially true with prohibitions in the Old Testament. So, and actually, then what is the laws about seed and cloth help us understand with the prohibition against cross-dressing is really all about? God's concern is with confusion and mixture. Paul reinforces the point of Deuteronomy 22:5 and 1 Corinthians 11 when he teaches that it is shameful for a woman to appear as a man, for a man to appear as a woman. Sexual differentiation is not a light matter to God. Now, one, because he means for us to reflect his image as male and female, and two, because he means for male and female to reflect Christ and the church. So God created mankind in general as a sexual binary, and he created each one of us as one the other, or one of the other. When we attempt to conceal God's design by dressing like men or women, or by dressing like women as men, then even worse, by seeking to alter our sexual anatomy as men and women, we not only reject God's good plan for us, we undermine the order he has established for all humanity. So I can see that he gives us now that more gritty biblical foundation as to the importance of accepting who we are as we're created the way we were, that we're fearfully, wonderfully made. And so this is a very wonderful, very brief, but very helpful biblical instruction as to why we affirm maleness and femaleness and all that God intended for his creation, and how we're to interact with that in the world in which we're living.
Yeah, and on that quote there, thankfully, while the pastoral and personal issues are complicated, the biblical teaching on the trans issues is not. You know, and that is so, that's a relief that we can go to the truth and we can go to. And when we are, if you are in a difficult situation with somebody, you know, you say, look, this is what God thinks about it. You know, it's not really about what I think. This is what God says. This is what God thinks. And that's anyway, that's just a relief. It's like when I will read Romans 1, you know, you look at the world and you look how terrible everything is. But for whatever reason, and this happened, I don't know, several years ago when I was reading Romans 1, and you were just kind of looking at this critique of man left to his own devices and how you just left alone, he's just going to descend and sin, and then eventually God's just going to give you over to the depraved mind. That was comforting to me in a way, just to see that, well, God already knows that this is how things can go. And it's comforting to read him describe it. It's comforting to read the realities of our depravity or in our potential depravity right there in Scripture. And then you see it in the world, and for whatever reason, it comforts me to know that it's in there. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. It's important for us to take that in. Really does. Number 9, Aaron Wren, there are plenty of good fish in the sea. He's talking about how we can find future, the potential, you know, mate in the, as Christians living in this world, and where are the fish, where are the fish in the ponds and the ponds where we can go fishing. He says, as I've noted many times, the degree of difficulty on the difficulty dial on finding a spouse and staying married has been turned up a lot in America. Falling marriage rates attest to the problems here, ranging from the rise of technology and mediated dating to an imbalance in college degree attainment between men and women to a politically polarizing dating environment. As at the same time, a bad macro environment does not necessarily determine our individual results. In some cases, these trends can help, even help up help a subset of people. For example, if more women than men are getting college degrees, then you are a man with a degree. In theory, that would work to your advantage. In other words, that's the pond you can fish in. However, I hear a lot of complaints from some singles about how this environment makes it all more but impossible to get married. For example, one of the tropes of the manosphere thinking is that the dating pool for men is poisoned. In their view, the American woman has ruined has been ruined as wife material by feminism, sleeping around with too many men, etc. So he just says that things are not going well. Well, in a fallen world, things are always can get askew, as we've already talked about with other articles, and this is just one other kind of way. And so so he says, at the risk of sounding like a white knight, my impression is that there are actually plenty of high quality single women in America, regardless of your theological or denominational persuasion. So I'm not completely sure why people have this view. And there's a huge shortage of marriageable woman women, and he gives some possibilities. But he ends up this way. I've made it clear that while I support people's right to make their own decision about their own lives, I view marriage and children as the normative life path and one that offers the most likely chance of flourishing. We are seeing less and less of that these days. So if you're a single man who wants to be married, you need to be intentionally working towards that in terms of preparing yourself and actively seeking out a wife. It's a risk. It is risky to ask a woman out on a date, especially in real life, which in my view is the only way to fly. Online dating is mug's game for most people. Even the most attractive guys will be rejected a lot. So there's nothing more natural than to look for ways not to do it. I think the idea that there aren't many good women to date functions as one of those ways. But whether you agree or not, the reality is that there are plenty of high quality single women and men in America. The problems of frustrated singleness are real and shouldn't be discounted. The technological and cultural problems in America when it comes to marriage are likewise real, but an absolute shortage of high caliber potential marriage partners is not one of those problems. So Aaron Wren is giving a very upbeat, positive statement here that the normative, that the natural factoring, the default setting for humans is to marry, unless God does something else and directs a person with a particular intent. And Paul does talk about it in other parts of scripture as well for it. So, but we have to put ourselves in a position to find that person. And God providentially does direct his children in how to meet each other. And since I've already said this is the 55th anniversary of my marriage, I believe that's what God did. And one day maybe I'll share the unique way in which God worked that out. It was quite unique and very special.
Well, so Paul, you know, I agree. I'd love to hear that. I'd love to hear that sometime.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, the online dating is really, I'm glad he points that out. It's just abysmal. It's hurting a lot. It's really hurting a lot of men who want to date women in their own peer group, because the women actually are ending up, better or worse, they're ending up dating men who are, you know, 8 to 10 years older than them. And so anyway, this is just, it's very interesting that's going on, but you know, likewise, on the other side of the coin, you know, Christian communities, Christian churches are actually thriving in many cases. I mean, if you look at, you know, if you look at birth rates and things like that, it's down. But if you look at the children that are in, you know, Christian churches and communities and from just this call conservative families, there's a ton of life. There's a ton of births that are happening. And so in that regard, likewise, you would assume that the marriage is happening as well, and people are finding each other, but it's just not there is this phenomenon out there, this idea out there that there aren't a lot of good prospects. I've talked to a friend of mine who's single and would just, man, I'm just like, man, how do you do it? Like, how do you, how do you find anybody to date these days because of intersectional feminism and just how, our culture is just so geared towards hookup culture and that sort of thing. Anyway, this is a good article.
Right. It does encourage, and no, we shouldn't be discouraged. And, don't let the culture drive the narrative, let the scripture and the Lord's providence drive you. The last article, number 10, recent Supreme Court decision. Supreme Court rules in favor of Colorado graphic designer who refused to create same-sex wedding websites. And maybe we could even put same-sex wedding messages because that was the issue of speech. So it says the U.S. Supreme Court held that a Colorado graphic designer who wants to make wedding websites does not have to create them for same-sex marriages in a landmark decision that pit the interest of the LGBTQ non-discrimination against First Amendment freedom. In a 6-3 decision, this was last Friday, the High Court ruled in favor of artist Lori Smith, who sued the state over an anti-discrimination law that prohibited businesses providing sales or other accommodations to the public from denying service based on a customer's sexual orientation. It was Justice Neil Gorsuch who authored the majority opinion, which said that in this case, Colorado seeks to force an individual to speak in ways that align with his views, but defy her conscience about a matter of major significance. But as the court has long held, the opportunity to think for ourselves and to express those thoughts freely is amongst the most cherished liberties and part of what keeps our republic strong. And so the thing was couched then either as accommodation, and therefore you have to do whatever it is you are offering in terms of service, or it was couched as a free speech opportunity, which meant that if something is contrary to my holdings, my views, violates my conscience, then I didn't do it. And if those are the, if that's the binary choice, then the Supreme Court fell on the side of the right of free speech. But there is more to it than that. And as many have said, it's good if we read through the way the Supreme Court ruled, the majority ruled, and how they framed it. There's more to it than just that simple summation. But the intent here was that the state of Colorado was seeking to impose a particular framework of how we are to express ourselves. And the Supreme Court said there has to be the freedom of expression, and you can't bind someone within that the categories of the culture. So it's, I think, very helpful. And this is going to have ripples effect for us in a beneficial way. And of course, this puts the onus on everyone who exercises his or her free speech to make sure that it's exercised well, and that you have a clear understanding of what you do believe, so that your conscience really does dictate how you use what that liberty, that freedom to express yourself.
I mean, you're exactly right, and it goes both ways. I mean, I personally have experienced this. I created a, Dominic, you probably know this, but I created a card game, and I made a deal with the print shop to print this card game. It's a conservative political game on the right, coming from a right wing perspective. Okay, no shocker there. We called it Left Wing Will and the Red Pill, right? And so anyway, contracted with this print shop, and once they saw the cards, which there's not a four letter word in the game, the designers of the card, they were upset with the company that they were going to print my game. And so they threatened to quit. And then the CEO of the company called me and said they weren't going to do my game because he can't afford to lose the designers. And while that was maddening to me, you know, very frustrating, I found somebody else to print it, right? I didn't go and pursue these people, not that I even would have had a case. But so this principle of, you know, you're not a conscript just because you're have a business, you're all of a sudden a conscript and can be forced to do whatever it is that somebody wants to make you do. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And you could take it, I mean, with the left's mindset on this, you should be forced to do the cake, or you should be forced to do the flowers, or forced to do the website. You know, that that's the way they think with like abortions. Like, well, if you want to be a doctor, you should be forced to do abortions, or you shouldn't be able to refuse to do the chemical castrations or the puberty blocking hormones. So this court case, this decision does have big implications, and it's good for as Christians who want to go about our lives in peace.
Right. Okay, well, those are the top 10 for this week, and this is July 5 of 2023. The newsletter went out on July 4th, and so you already have it in your box. And if you have got it and you like these top 10, feel free to share them, to forward the newsletter to others that they may want to sign up to the Akula Report newsletter each week. Just a reminder, the news, these top 10 articles were on the Akula Report, and it was the readers of the Akula Report that, as they read articles, clicked on them, and that's what makes the top 10. So right now, during this week, there are articles that are up that by next Tuesday, when the newsletter comes out, we will have a top 10 from the readers of the Akula Report saying, this is, I like this, and I'm, or I enjoyed reading this, I click it and read it. So we appreciate you listening to the Akula Report Weekly Review, and trust that the Lord will continue to watch over your way, because the Lord loves the way of the righteous.